Tonight is technically the beginning of the new quarter, and Brother Greg is actually teaching this quarter, but they did a spring break. They're out of town, and he asked that I fill in for him, which worked out good. I'm certainly not glad that he's not here. Don't mean that at all, but it worked out good from the standpoint where I was gone, that this gave an additional week to try to get through the book. How are you feeling on the book of Hebrews? I feel pretty good about the book, although on the other hand, I feel like I've ran a marathon. It certainly has been a long quarter, but a good quarter. I hope you feel the same way. I hope that it's been of benefit to you, that you see worth in the study of the book of Hebrews. And I certainly am not conceited by any means to think that I've covered this book the best that it ought to be covered. But I hope that the things that I've put together, the PowerPoint slides, which is about 215 of them, have been worth your time to make notes on and to study through this good book. I've enjoyed the book of Hebrews. If you could sum up this book, how would you do that? What would you say? Someone down the line says, hey, by the way, what's the book of Hebrews about? What will you tell us? Yeah, that's right. We have a better covenant today than what they had before Jesus, before the cross. What else might you tell someone?
Superiority over it, which ties in really what he said. Mm-hmm. Right. Compares them both, pretty much in detail, compares them and
That's right. Really, the whole book, as we've stated throughout our study, is a book of contrasts. That it's contrasting Jesus with various things that we read about under the Old Testament law. Because of purpose, again, the people to whom he is writing this, it's indicated, what was their problem? Who was he writing to, and what was the importance of them receiving this letter?
Tendency to go back into the old law and Judaism.
That's right.
He's laying the groundwork that those things are finished, fulfilled, and the new covenant is here. We have a superior high priest. We have a superior everything.
That's right. And so, and again, he's dealing with individuals who are in danger of completely forsaking Christianity and going back. Now, other books of the New Testament deal with individuals who were not forsaking Christianity, but they were trying to kind of mingle in Christianity some of the aspects from the Old Testament law. You remember an example of that?
One of them said that you had to be circumcised.
Yeah, that's right. They had that Jerusalem conference that's referred to sometimes in Acts 15 when they sent to the apostles and the elders at Jerusalem to consider that matter when some of the Jews were telling the Christians, you have to go back and be circumcised like they were under the Old Testament law. And Paul deals with that in Galatians. And he tells him that famous statement that we often use, Galatians 5:4, that whosoever of you are justified by the law, you are fallen from grace. We need to teach people that today, that if we leave Christianity and attempt to go back under the Old Testament law of Moses, that we're not in a right relationship with God. Whether it's we're trying to completely forsake Christianity or we're trying to leave the New Testament, the perfect law of liberty, and try to keep some things under the Old Testament law. By the way, which people try to do today, don't they?
The Ten Commandments is a perfect example.
That's right.
Their people's yards, their people's houses, their homes, everywhere.
That's right.
It's a big issue with people when they try
to
take them out of the courthouse.
Mm-hmm. We're not under that law. They're inspired, there's no doubt about that, but we're simply not under that law. So chapter 12, and we'll, Lord willing, go through chapter 12 and chapter 13 in our study night. This chapter really has to do with exhortations to have the same kind of confidence and perseverance as those that were mentioned in chapter 11. In chapter 11, it's pretty well filled full with examples of what?
Faith.
Of faith.
And the works.
And the works. Someone's once talked about it, and I thought it was a really good statement, that chapter 11 is not really just a chapter about faith, because sometimes we look at faith and we say, well, he's just talking about believing in God. That's not what chapter 11 is about. It's about faith that is acceptable to God. And the faith that is acceptable to God is the faith that has obedience, the faith that compels one and moves one to obey what God has stated. Any other thoughts about chapter 11? It's a good chapter. Perseverance, exhortations to have the same confidence and perseverance as those of chapter 11. Verses 1 through 3, he says, "Wherefore, seeing we also are compassed about with so great a cloud of witnesses, let us lay aside every weight and the sin which does so easily beset us, and let us run with patience the race that is set before us, looking unto Jesus, the author and finisher of our faith, who for the joy that was set before him endured the cross, despising the shame, and is set down at the right hand of the throne of God. For consider him that endured such contradiction of sinners against himself, lest ye be wearied and faint in your minds." Now that's a mouthful just in 3 verses. But notice that it begins by saying, "Wherefore, seeing we are also compassed about with so great a cloud of witnesses." And so he continues the thought. He doesn't stop with verse 30 of chapter 11 and then move into something different. He's saying, notice these things in light, what he's getting ready to say. He said, notice what I'm getting ready to tell you in light of what I've just stated in chapter 11. "Wherefore, seeing we have such a great cloud of witnesses." Well, what's that great cloud of witnesses that he's talking about? Some of your versions may not use the word cloud. Some of your the version that you're using, some of you do not. Does it render that differently? Some may have instead of cloud, that's what the King James said, some may say a crowd, a throng, a host or company. It's like Mark talked about. He's referencing all of those individuals that he mentions in chapter 11. "Wherefore, seeing that all of those people are a witness to us." Now, automatically, usually anyway, when we think about witness, what do we think about?
Someone who sees something.
Someone who's like a spectator, right? They see something. Mark sees that a lot in his work. Maybe you've been a witness to a car accident, or you've been a witness to one thing or another. It can be the idea here, but another way that it might be talking about is not so much that they have witnessed something, but they are a testimony. Some of your versions may say testimony, that they are actually a record or a testimony to us. They are witnessing or testifying to us. What are we learning from them? Various sources, if you look that up, will render that differently. Strong's renders it differently than Vine does. And if you use Vincent Ward's studies of the New Testament, it talks about it in a different light than what Strong's and Vine's does. But anyway, that gives us an idea that he's tying this together. And he says, let us lay aside every weight. In light of the fact that these people were faithful to God, they did things in which they didn't see the outcome, but they were convinced of the outcome. Remember that from chapter 11? These died having not received the promises, but yet they all died in faith from chapter 11. Let us lay aside the weight which does so easily beset us, a sin. Let me ask you the question before we move on. He says, let us lay aside every weight. What does he mean by weight? Someone just said, begin with the S. Okay, sin. Now, I've often looked at that too, but notice that he says, let us lay aside the weight and the sin. Now, if weight is in reference to sin, why would he say, let us lay aside every sin and the sin that does so easily beset us? You see? Yeah. And I think that's a more accurate meaning of what he's talking about. In other words, yes, we are to lay aside the sin that doth so easily beset us, the King James Version, which means to encircle us. Let us get rid of that. Let us purge out the sin. But when he talks about let us lay aside the weight, to get rid of every unnecessary thing in our life that would hinder us from running the race. Now that's a mouthful to me. Because you think about it, there's a lot of things that we may have in our life that's really not wrong in and of itself, but they end up being a burden or a hindrance to us as we run our race. And he's saying get rid of it. Get rid of everything that would hinder you from having the kind of faith that those people in chapter 11 had. Well, there may be a lot of things in our lives that fall under that category of not wrong, but it's a hindrance. Can you think of something? You don't have to answer out loud. But think about things along the way that wasn't wrong, but it ended up being a hindrance. I think about material possessions sometimes. Things that we just want really, really bad, and it's not wrong, but it just ends up being a hindrance along the way. Give you a quick example of that. It might be a poor example, but still, when me and Tracy first got married, we lived in a single-wide trailer. Happiest people in the world. Renting this trailer. And then in the process of time, we got our first house. And we were so happy about that. We had this huge garage. It was a detached garage. And you know what was in that garage? When we got all moved in, you know what was there? One lonely box. We said, we will never fill up this garage. Well, guess what happened? In process of time, in 2014, when it came time to pack our bags and move to Laurel County, what a hindrance. Things that we just felt like we couldn't do without were packed up in the garage, and it was just a hindrance. Now, of course, it didn't hinder us spiritually, but sometimes things that we don't look at as being a hindrance at the time, if we're not careful, they will weight us down. As we try to run with patience, some of your versions say what instead of patience? Yeah, with endurance. That's really a better rendering than what the King James Version has. But let us run the race that is set before us. Paul talked about 1 Corinthians 9, 24 through 27, about running a race. Remember that? We're to look away from everything and everybody and look to Jesus, who is the author, the preacher, the perfecter of our faith. Now, that doesn't mean that we shirk our responsibilities to family and friends and employers and government and all of that. But that means that we need to be solely fixed on looking to Jesus. And again, in the context of this, you don't go back and look at the prophets. You don't go back and look to Moses. Don't go back and look to your father Abraham as the standard for what you need to be doing. But you need to be looking to Jesus, who's the author and the finisher of our faith. Any thoughts about that point?
My Bible actually had a memo about the weight. It says that even good things can hinder.
Yeah, that's right.
If you burden yourself with other things of any kind.
Well, that's right. I love to eat, and sometimes around lunchtime I eat so much of it. It is so good, but it hinders my work in the afternoon. So, too much of a good thing may be bad. Who, for the joy that was set before him, what did he do? Who, for the joy that was set before him, what did Jesus do? He endured the cross, despising the shame. What do you suppose that he's talking about, and I'm not sure that I fully understand this phrase, when he says, who for the joy that was set before him, do you think that implies that Jesus made a selfish act by going to the cross because he knew what he was going to receive afterward? I don't either. I don't think that's what he's talking about. In fact, I believe what Jesus did was a selfless act. That he put the needs of others before the needs of himself. But what does he mean, who for the joy that was set before him? What could be included in that? It's not really clear in the text. When you think about the joy that was set before it, well, obviously the pain was a joy to experience. The ridicule and the shame was not a joy or a pleasurable experience. But who for the joy that was set before him endured these things?
Maybe restating your selfless comment, but I mean, he made possible the salvation for all of us. Yeah. That's what he desires. That's why he was joyful about that. He was the price for sin. He was going to save our souls.
I think absolutely that would fit there. Who knew what it was going to bring about. But, that's right. But the glory also, in addition to that, that would be revealed in him after that. Not because he was selfish, but he prayed in John chapter 17, I think it's verse 5, check me on it. Father, glorify thou me with thyself, with the glory which I had with thee before the world was. And now seated at the right hand of the Father, a place of authority, reigning as King of kings and Lord of lords. Verses 12 and 13, don't grow weary. In light of the fact, and you think about all the examples, and these are not all of the examples that a person could have used in chapter 11, but these are the ones that God saw fit for us to have. As another person was teaching the book of Hebrews, they made the comment about verse 32 that he was appreciative that God had chosen to put these people there as examples of people who died in faith, and yet we can go back and many of them read where they did wrong. He mentions David. Well, was David a perfect person? No. I mean, actually did something pretty horrible when you think about it. And yet he's listed here as one of the people who these all died in faith. How does that help us? Again, in verses 12 and 13, he's saying, wherefore lift up the hands which hang down and the feeble knees, and make straight paths for your feet, lest that which is lame be turned out of the way, but let it rather be healed. Don't grow weary. Don't give up. What that teaches us is that even though these people were imperfect, even though they did wrong, they were still able to die in faith in a right relationship with God. Necessitated repentance on their part, confessing that to God, acknowledging that they did wrong. But in spite of the fact that they did those things, they could still be in a right relationship with God when they did what God required of them. Suppose chapter 11 was filled full with examples of people who had never sinned before, they were perfect, never did wrong. Well, how's that going to motivate me when I know I've committed wrong, when I know that I'm not perfect? Galatians 6:9, let us not be weary in well-doing, for in due season, we shall reap if what? If we faint not. I think some of your versions may say, if we do not lose heart, instead of that faint. Verses 14 through 17, falling short of the grace of God. Notice what he says. Follow peace with all men and holiness, without which no man shall see the Lord. Verse 15, looking diligently, lest any man fail of the grace of God, lest any root of bitterness spring up, trouble you, and thereby many be defiled. Is he writing to Christian people in Hebrews? Shake or nod. He is, right? We've looked at that through the book. The examples, the statements that are made that teach us that He's writing to Christian people, they were partakers of the divine calling. If they were sinners, they were not partakers of the divine calling. But notice what He says, look and diligently, lest any man fail of the grace of God. What prevalent denominational teaching does that verse knock the props out from under? Huh? Yeah. Many of them, if not all of them. But think of that. Lest any of you fail of the grace of God. Once saved, always saved. These people were saved. These people were in a relationship with God. In danger of apostatizing? Absolutely. But He's saying, beware. Remember chapter 3? I think it's verse 12. Take heed, brethren, lest there be in any of you an evil heart of unbelief in what? In departing. Departing where? Or from what? It's God. Departing from the living God. Esau's given as an example. So again, we can fall from a right relationship with God, and this was a real and present danger for these Christians. Verses 18 through 24, I know that speedily, but I told you I could spend the entire time on one chapter, and we're almost there. Verses 18 through 24, a contrast between the old and the new, and you can go look at that, and we've spent a lot of time on that. But notice verses 25 through 29. We're not going to talk about every verse. But I really like this statement. This would preach. This would be a good sermon. See that you refuse not him that speaketh. Is it possible to know that God speaks and yet we turn a deaf ear to God's word? Absolutely. And then notice the interchangeableness of church and kingdom in verse 23 and 28. Not every time does the word kingdom mean church, but sometimes it doesn't. In this chapter, it's used that way. We therefore, having received a kingdom which cannot be moved. An everlasting kingdom. Daniel 2:44. And hopefully by now, you have read the book. In chapter 13, our last lesson, which is 14, is practical exhortations. You think about all of the things that we have talked about in these these 12 chapters. And there's so much more that could be said. So much more that I need to learn about this great book of Hebrews. And then he sums up in this last chapter with some things that are so fundamental to the Christian faith, practical things that we need to be doing each and every day of our lives and being faithful to God. And I want us to go through some of them. The first one's verse 1. Let brotherly love continue. Someone has once said, in order for brotherly love to continue, it must first exist. I agree with that. You can't let something continue when it wasn't there to begin with. Do we love our brethren? If so, what kind of love do we have for others? I don't know if you've ever experienced it or ever been around it. Maybe you have, but certainly me and Tracy has witnessed it and see what happens to congregations when there is an absence of the love. I'm not saying there's an absence of love, but an absence of the love that should have been present. I'm talking about the love where we would lay aside our own desires and try to exhort the other person and encourage them and put their needs above our own. You think there's a lack of that in the body of Christ today, in general? I agree with you. I'm not saying that that's present here, but I'm saying if we're not careful, that we may have a love for one another, that's just in word only. That's easy to do. It's easy to grow complacent and callous to various things, whatever the case may be. But let brotherly love continue. John 13:35, by this shall all men know that ye are my disciples, if you have love one for another. Now think about that. We don't have long, but he said, by this, and he's talking about the love that they're to have for one another, shall all men know that ye are my disciples, if you have that love. In other words, it's evident to other people that there is something peculiar about that group of people when they are able to witness our interaction with one another, our care for one another, our concern for one another. And you know, generally speaking, the world wants to be a part of that. Someone, I can't remember who coined this or where I even first ran across it, but someone told me at one point there's two needs that people generally need, and that is to love and to be loved. Everybody needs to be loved and everybody needs to love. That's important. And the book of 1 John, all the way through it, I didn't put a chapter and verse because the whole book is based on the concept of God is love. Love your brother. He that hateth his brother is a murderer, and you know that no murderer hath eternal life abiding in him. Love others. That's so hard to do sometimes. Especially when we've been wrong, we've been hurt, our feelings are hurt, whatever the case may be. But you know, I'm sure that Jesus, who was tempted like in all points as we are, we've studied that in this book, and yet he was a master at putting the needs of others above the needs of himself. Philippians chapter 2, the first 5 verses talks about that. Verse 2, be hospitable. And I don't say a lot about that. We studied that for a quarter on works of the individual members of the local body. But do good unto others as the opportunity presents itself. Galatians 6:10. Romans 12:13 talks about being hospitable. 1 Peter 4:9. 1 John 3:17, whosoever hath this world's goods and seeth his brother have need and shutteth up his bowels of compassion, how dwelleth the love of God in him. Verse 3, remember them that are in bonds as bound with them. It's a big statement. 1 Corinthians 12:25-26. Rejoice with those that rejoice. Weep with those that weep. Acts 14:22 and a host of other verses that talk about that. 2 Timothy 1:16-18, when he talks about a particular individual who had sought him out and did good unto him, refreshed him. Verse 4, marriage is honorable in all. You see how these thoughts really break away one from the other. I mean, he starts out by talking about brotherly love, then he talks about being hospitable. Hospitable, yeah, it's connected to brotherly love, but really that's a separate topic. And then he talks about marriage is honorable and all. Yeah, all of these should have love in them. But you see how he's really not talking about the same thing all the way through. Marriage is honorable and all, in the bed undefiled, but whoremongers and adulterers God will judge. Do we ever need a lesson on that in 2016? That the only place in which the bed is not defiled is within marriage. Cohabitating doesn't cut it. Shacking up, or however you want to frame it, whoremongers and adulterers God will judge. In other words, they're not getting away with it. That's not saying that we are not to point that out according to the Scriptures. He's not saying, listen, God's the judge, don't you be the judge of these people. God's the judge. Yes, God is the judge. And the point that He is wanting them to see is they won't get away with it. And neither will Donna get away with anything that I do in my life. And that is sobering thought as he's concluding this book. That when we have problems or we have sin, if somebody can get the first vow, I don't think it was wrong. That we're not getting by with those things. Proverbs 18:22, whosoever findeth a wife, findeth what? A good thing. And obtaineth favor of the Lord. I think Tracy's a keeper. I think she's pretty good. So, again, this is God's design. God designed marriage. He ordained this. Verses 5 and 6. Our dependence on God. Verse 5 instructs that our conversation, some of your versions may say conduct, be without covetousness. There's a lot of things that can fall under covetousness, idolatry, and a host of other things. 1 Timothy 6, 6 through 11. We brought nothing into this world, it's certain we'll carry nothing out, but having food and raiment, let us there be with content. Godliness with contentment is great gain. For the love of money, what does he say? Is a root of all evil, which while some coveted after. That's why I put that reference there. Let it be without covetousness. Which while some coveted after, they vary from the faith, pierce themselves through with many sorrows. Matthew 6:11. Give us this day our daily bread. A dependence on God. Verses 7 and 8. Remember them which have the rule over you. And I'll just be honest with you, there is a lot more in that statement than what I had the time really to get around to study on who this particular verse is in reference to. Now later on we're going to have a reference to those that have the rule over you in reference to the elders. I'm not so sure that this is what, that is what this verse is talking about. But nonetheless, you can study that and see what you can find out. But in light of that, Jesus too ought to be considered and does not change. Jesus is saying today, yesterday, today, and forever. Be careful with that verse because sometimes you may have individuals say, now wait just a minute. The Lord I serve is the same yesterday, today, and forever. And so if He was okay with it on the other side of the cross, if He was okay with it in the Old Testament, well then He's okay with it today. And so I'll just go ahead and play my trumpet all I want to in the worship to God. You see how that reasoning, Jesus approved or God approved of it then, well, and since He doesn't change, He approves of it today. That has nothing to do with what He's talking about in that. Certainly not in the context of it. Verse 9, be not carried about with divers and strange doctrines. By the way, how is it possible to be carried about if you can't fall from a right relationship with God? Why the admonition? Be steadfast, 1 Corinthians 15:58, Ephesians 4:14, that we henceforth be no more children, carried about and tossed to and fro with every wind of doctrine. Ephesians 4:5, there is but one faith, that is one teaching. 10 through 13, Jesus is superior. Verse 14, here we have no continuing city, but we seek one to come. This world is not our home. I love that hymn, this world is not my home. We're going to get through this real quick as people are coming down. By Him, therefore, as a result of what Jesus did, we can offer the sacrifice of our lips to God continually and acceptably. We don't have to go back to the Old Testament law in order to be pleasing to God. We can stay this side of the cross and be acceptable to God. Obey them that have the rule over you. Elders are soul watchers. 18 through 25, the conclusion to the book. There will be no other testament or covenant as he states in verse 20 through the blood of the everlasting covenant. No other covenant. And that's the book of Hebrews. Jesus is greater. Jesus is superior in every way. I hope it's been a good quarter for you as much as it has been for me in studying this and thinking about the book of Hebrews. Any thoughts or questions, comments, whatever, before we close our study? I appreciate your good attention.